Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Endless Spiral podcast. I am, as always, your host, Keith Russell. On this episode, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by ex-professional footballer Mark O'Brien. You may or may not be familiar with Mark's story, but it's an incredible journey, and I'm delighted that Mark has given up some time to come on and have a chat with us today. So hello, Mark, how are you?
Yeah, grand. Thanks, yourself.
Yeah, I'm not too bad, actually. We were just chatting beforehand about the football, but we probably best off not talking about too much, or we'll just be sitting here in tears for the next half an hour.
You're not wrong.
Oh, tell me about it. Well, and as I was saying in the intro, Max, your story is, I think anyway, it's a story of kind of bravery and inner strength and resilience and inspiration. You know, and even when I was just thinking about this earlier, even when I was saying strength to myself, it's not even physical strength, although obviously you would be an ex-professional footballer, you needed that. But obviously, like, we chatted recently, and it's a lot, you've an incredible amount of mental inner strength as well. And like, if people aren't too familiar with your story, you obviously had to retire from football very early due to heart conditions. And that, like I said, we chatted recently, and it's an incredible story, and we'll get to that. But I wonder if we could start at the beginning, because I'm kind of interested, I'm sure everyone else is interested to know kind of what you were like as a kid. And did you always have that kind of inner strength there, or did you even know you had it? So, like, obviously, growing up in Dublin, like myself, what was it like for you?
Like, I loved growing up. Like, I don't think I would ever be prepared for the mental kind of strength that I've needed through a lot of things that have gone on in my life. But I always felt as though I was a grounded person. Like, I was brought up like any other Irish kid. I was out on the streets, so I was playing football with my friends, and as you say, like, it felt like normal to me. But like, even in school, I was just someone that got on with school work, enjoyed helping people, enjoyed like being around all my mates and stuff like that. And there was never really anything that went on in me, like, younger self, that I actually had to deal with, or that I had to kind of come to terms with, or there wasn't really much that I kind of, as you say, up until now, know that there was like that inner strength to deal or cope with a lot of different things. But growing up, I had a really good upbringing, and my family, my parents, like, they were brilliant. Like, I never went without anything, but I was never, like, as you say, I wasn't spoiled as a child. I wasn't someone that he got given the world, but I never went without anything. So it was, I just see it as, like, I was just like a normal kid growing up in Dublin, and just loved every minute of it. And just being in and around your friends, as I've said already, that I was just out on the street and, like you say, kicking a ball off a wall. And that's where it all began for me.
And do you have any siblings?
I have one brother who's 2 years older than me. And again, he was someone who I looked up to when we were younger. Like, we came to loggerheads every so often, as you do with a brother. Like, and you have your little back and forwards between them, but he was someone that played football. He was someone that, like, was doing really well for himself and was going places, and I just wanted to follow in his footsteps. Anything that he done, I wanted to do, and anything that he achieved, I wanted to achieve. And in the same family that when he won Ireland Under 16 Player of the Year, I won Ireland Under 16 Player of the Year 2 years later. So it is kind of a strange one, but at the same time, it was something that once he done something, and he was somebody that I looked up to a lot for everything he was doing so well for.
Yeah, like, I suppose obviously he's competitive, but obviously I'm sure he looked after and he was protective of you as well.
Yeah, he was always protective of me, and it was one of those things where I was always, like, my brother James. I was always James's younger brother. Like, that's what I always was. Like, oh, James is doing really well. Oh, you're James's younger brother. Like, he was always like the kind of main name of everything. And again, as I say, I just followed in his footsteps of anything that he done, I done. He went and played for Cherry Orchard. I'd go play for Cherry Orchard. And
yeah,
he flew away when he was 16. I flew away when I was 15. So it was in the family, and it was something, like you say, he was always there. He was always there when I needed him, or he was always there. I had someone to go out onto the streets and kick a ball with just as much.
Yeah. The reason why I was asking about your childhood is because, you know, sometimes, or actually a lot of the time, when people kind of have to deal with kind of trauma or something, you know, as severe as you had when they're, you know, older in life, although you were still young, you're, you know, a little bit older. Usually there's like a, some sort of childhood trauma, or there's usually something there that, you know, might have like kind of triggered them in some way, you know. But like, I suppose, like, you're probably around my age, and I suppose we grew up in an age where, like, well, I grew up in an age anyway. I won't assume too much. But I grew up in an age where there was no social media really when I was a kid, like, and now we've got social media everywhere. I mean, I suppose that types of that, like, you know, having social media now, it can be like really detrimental to kids as well. And I suppose when you're that focused within, I suppose you wanted to be a footballer very early on. So you didn't have an awful lot of distractions. You were able to just focus on that all the time, was it?
Yeah, and that's how I felt it was, and it gave me a childhood. It gave me something like not having social media, having friends knock on your door and ask you to come out and play, and that was your source of entertainment. That was your kind of, I want to be outside with my friends. Like, you were never wanting to be indoors because you knew everybody was outside kicking a ball, playing games. And that was the childhood I was brought up in. Like, we didn't have Instagram, Twitter, all these different things. It was like, so like, you weren't allowed a phone until a certain age. So all you had was your mates to knock into next door, and you'd go to a neighbor's house, you go to your mate's house, they'd come out and play, and then you go and knock on somebody else's door. And it's something, like you say, it's memories to look back on that I'm kind of glad that I grew up at that stage, because it did give me a childhood. It gave you a way to interact with people and get really close connections with friends, because I think nowadays it's a lot more difficult to get that close connection with friends. So I still have the same friends that I grew up with 20 years later, and I still have all them now.
Yeah, and great point.
Having all of them friends that are still now all started from we grew up together. We were always out together. We were always doing things together. Whereas now, everyone's only a text away. So even if you don't see somebody face to face, you've got virtual friends. But that's why I think sometimes that potentially there are that few more struggles, because when that person or friend isn't sitting next to you, it's easy to switch your phone off. It's easy to lock your phone up. It's easy to press the off button and sit in your own stuff. But when you have a friend sitting there next to you, you've got people around you, it's a lot harder to lock it away, and you have to speak about it and deal with it. And as I say, I was lucky enough to grow up in that age where those friends, it's a friendship for life.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point, actually. Yeah, that you can just kind of switch off from the world when you feel like it, isn't it? That's actually a great point, where if I have someone there in the room with you, obviously it's a lot harder to switch off. It's a great point, actually, you know. So obviously, as you were getting older, you were playing for Cherry Orchard and you're starting to get recognised, and those companies talk that you're going to be going to England. So, I mean, that must be incredibly daunting. I mean, what, you were six? Were you 16 when you went to Bristol? Did you say, or did you say 15?
I was 15 when I flew away to Derby.
When you're 15, so like obviously going over to England at a young age of 15, like how do you feel about that? Obviously, you're excited about going, but like obviously you're leaving everyone behind. I mean, that must be very like tough to deal with.
Yeah, it was tough to deal with, but I had football was like the core of everything, I think, for moving away and going away. And I knew I was going to get to play football every single day. It wasn't going to be a pastime. It was something that I was doing every single day. So I could have been moving halfway around the world and I still would have just went away and enjoyed playing football. I think that's something that I was kind of lucky that I didn't struggle with, was the homesickness. Like, obviously, even still to this day, I miss my family. Still this day, I still miss friends. To this day, like, you miss all your home comforts. But me flying away and getting to do something that I was like dreaming of doing, there was nothing that was going to stop me. And that became like my main focus of moving away. So as difficult as it was, I think it was more difficult for my family because I was so young. It was difficult for my mom because I think, as everybody knows, an Irish mammy, you want to be around. She wants you to still be living at home till you're grey and old. But it is one of them things that I think she struggled probably more with it. But when she knows that it was our son going away to live his dream, they never stood in my way. They were as supportive as possible. So when I knew I had the support of my family and I knew it was something I wanted to do, and the older that I got, I realized that if it's something that's not for me, Dublin was only 40-minute flight away. So it wasn't like I had to move away forever. It was something where I'm making this choice. I'm enjoying my football and this is what I want to do. So I was kind of like lucky in that aspect that homesickness never really came into it because the passion of football just took over.
Yeah. Did you ever have any inkling to go home?
I did after a couple of years of being away, like through some difficult times that I had at one or two clubs. I felt like I've had enough of this. Like I've had injuries along the way. I've had like the operations along the way. But when I was getting kind of, I would look at it and say mistreated at a certain club, I really struggled because I was thinking, what am I doing this for? I've fought through so many different things, and this was the first time that I ever kind of contemplated thinking, I think I'm done here. I don't have anything left in me. But there was always still that little kind of thought in the back of your mind of just saying, just keep going. Yeah. Like, just keep going. Because I think we all get to a point where there is always that one moment that you'll always remember of whether you kind of sink or swim. And to kind of put it in a nutshell, like I chose to just keep going, and I just chose to not kind of do that because I didn't want to live with any regret for myself. That regret was something that lives with you forever, whereas I could make that choice, and then if I gave it a go again, it was something that I, at least I can always look at myself and go, well, at least I stuck with it, and if it didn't work out, well then so be it, but I won't have that regret. But if I gave up right at the beginning, it's something that I don't think I'd be able to shake off and think, well, do you know what? Maybe if I should have just tried one more time. And I never wanted that feeling. And thankfully, I just kept going, and it did turn around for me.
Yeah, that's what I was saying at the beginning about the resilience part of your story. It's incredible. And you probably saw recently, I put up something on Instagram about no regrets, something similar to what you were saying. You just can't live with regrets anymore. It just doesn't work. Like the Robbie Williams song, I think you even had that in the background. They don't work. Well, like you were talking about the difficult times, so let's go and talk about that because we kind of touched on it at the beginning, but we haven't really gone into it in too much detail. So obviously I'm familiar with it, but do you want to kind of explain to people where, so you went to England, you're with Derby, you're flying, you're feeling great, you made your debut in front of 20,000 people, things can't be better, and then something happens, didn't it?
Yeah, so after the season, I made my debut and I was only 16. Went home to Dublin. Everything was fine. So I flew back for that pre-season and everything was at my feet. Everybody was I was talk of Derby, that there's this new 16-year-old who's coming in and he's flying. And then we had a routine heart scan because I was able to get scanned because I was registered with Derby County at the time. And they found that I had like a leak in my aortic valve, which was something that I was unaware of. I didn't have a single symptom. I just was going about training like normal. And I had the scan, found out it was leaking. So sat down with the specialist and he told me, look, you won't need an operation for 60, 70 years. And I thought, great, football will be finished in 60, 70 years. Like I don't need to worry. Carried on training, heart rate monitors, like I was wearing, and then found out that my heart rate was like twice as high as everybody else's, up around 223, and the average was 203, and was just never really returning in like the midst of training, like any rest period, my heart rate was just not coming back down. So they tried to put two and two together and realised, well, do you know what? This could be the cause of it. So went and seen another specialist who sent me for an MRI. And then in the MRI scan, they told me on a scale of 1 to 10, the valve is leaking up to about a 7 or an 8. And that's when I think alarm bells start ringing. But again, I was told, look, you won't need another operation for 20 to 30 years. And like I say, this was all 14 years ago, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. And we got sent on to another specialist who then looked at the results and said, look, I'm going to have to refer you to a surgeon. But you won't need to worry. The operation won't be for, it could be for another 10 to 20 years. So in all this time, it went from 70, 80 years down to 10 to 20 years. But still, I was only 16. All I had in my head was, well, look, football could be long gone by then. Like, I don't have to worry. So I was still doing like bits of light training in between. And then we went to see the surgeon. So my family flew over, my ma, my dad, and then the physio. We were all sitting in the office, and the surgeon came in, and again, he walked straight past me, sat down at his desk, had a model heart in his hand, and he just looked at me, and he said, look, he said, Mark, your heart is 3 times the size of what it should be. And if you don't get this operation done now or this year, you're going to die.
Wow.
Now, that was something that was, that was something that it felt like a kind of out-of-body experience. Like, you can't be talking to me like I've just made my debut, and now you're telling me I'm going to die. Like, what's actually happening? And I could see by my family's faces, they were shocked. The physio was shocked. But the only question that I asked to the doctor was, can I still play football? And he looked at me, he explained what the reasoning for it was. He said, look, he said, your heart is like, he said, just say it's like a balloon that you've only just freshly taken out of a pack. He said, if you blow that up to the max it can go and let it go back down, he said, but it never goes back down to normal shape. He said, your heart just keeps expanding and won't go back down to normal shape. So basically, he said, there could be one morning you'll wake up and he said, you'll be exhausted and you'll be tired. He said, do you not feel any of the symptoms? And I said, I don't feel any symptom. So he said it to me. He said, like, look, your heart is on this verge of expanding and expanding until it's ready just to stop. And he said, yes, your operation is needed sooner rather than later. So with that question of asking, can I play? He just said to me, he said, look, Mark, he said, you'll be lucky to play down the park with your friends. He said, I don't think professional football is something that is even on the table for you anymore. So you kind of take that, and that probably information hurt me more than thinking I needed open heart surgery, because when you're 16, you don't really understand circumstances or situations. You just kind of think of it as an operation. So I never really took on board the heart stuff. I took on board the fact he said I'll never play again. So that kind of really, really stuck out for me. And he gave me the options of the operations. He said, look, you can get a metallic valve in, which means you'll never play football again because you'll be on blood thinners for the rest of your life. Or he said, on the other side, he said, we can put a pigskin valve in. And a pigskin valve means that, he said, you have a slight chance of potentially getting back playing football. But he said, on a professional level, he said, your fitness levels probably won't reach that. So he said, it will give you a chance of living normally and maybe getting back, but there won't be a chance. So I just listened to the small window of chance of saying, well, maybe there might be a chance. I'll give it everything I can. And I chose the pigskin valve straight away. I didn't even think about the metallic valve. I didn't think about for the rest of my life. I just thought, what can I do for football? So my family went along with it. And I think it was at that moment that was where the resilience began throughout my whole career. That's when the love of football gave me that resilience. They kind of, I'm doing this for football and that's all that I've got. So it was the point of once he said it to me, he said, like, look, we had a girl gymnast in who had the operation as you. She tried to go back down gymnastics and he said, within 18 months, the valve failed. So you needed another one and she had to stop. So he said to me that it might last me a year to a maximum of 5 years, but he said, there's no guarantee. We can't tell you it'll be exactly this, but he said, like, football probably won't ever happen. And I just took that as, well, I'm going to have the operation once, which gave me the opportunity to say with that no regret. It kind of gave me the chance of thinking, I want to give it one last go. I want to give it that one last big push. And if it comes off, brilliant. If it doesn't, well, then at least I tried. At least I gave it that chance that I didn't want to, again, jump at that one opportunity to think, right, I'm going to take the easy way out. I'm going to just have the operation and that's me done with football. I wanted to try and make something because I had my debut the season before, so I knew exactly what to expect and I knew what football meant and I knew what football was going to give me, and that adrenaline rush, that kind of playing in front of thousands of people, like I couldn't just give up on that within the first kind of tough situation. And like, thankfully I had the operation and I was successful and I ended up getting an 11-year career out of it. And getting 11 years when I got told probably I won't even get one or a maximum of 5, like, it was something where, like, the the career that I had, I've created probably more memories and more different things. And I look at it as a kind of a blessing to say football saved me life. Like the fact that I played football saved me life. The fact I was at a club like Derby County, they saved me life. And it was the fact of looking at it in a way of saying that molded my career into wherever came my way, there was going to be nothing to stop me. So as much as it was a tough thing to go through at 16, I'm actually thankful for going through it at 16 in the strangest way, because it set me up nicely for the kind of mental resilience I needed for living away from home.
Yeah. Jesus. Like, talk about like a roller coaster of emotions, like in such a short space of time. So you make your debut in front of 20,000 people, you're at a high, and then you get this routine heart scan, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh shit. So you start to, you know, probably anxiety kicks in. Then you're told, oh, well, it'll be probably 67 years away. So you're grand. So you start to relax. Then you go to someone else and the time gradually starts eroding away from you. Like, fuck me. So like, what was the time difference between, or the time scale between, you know, going to the first, or getting the heart scan and being told 60, 70, 80 years to being told a year? Like, what was it, a couple of weeks probably, was it? Or was it months or days?
It was more like a month or two in between. Mm. So like, I would have had this scan about, let's say, I would have had the scan start to middle of July. And then after that, you find out it's a minor leak. Mm. And then a week or two or a couple after that, me training sessions and the heart rate monitor, then all of a sudden they put two and two together, and then it went another couple of weeks. And then it got to about start of October. So about 3 months of scans and training, not really playing. And just like thinking the time scale is dropping, but in the space of 3 months isn't a long time. But the 3 month gap between all of that went from 60 to 80 years straight down to when I seen the surgeon and he said I can do it in the next 2 weeks. And that in itself was that part was the scary part. But also I was again thankful for it because it didn't give me any wiggle room to think about it. He said in the next 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks' time, I was having open heart surgery. In 2 weeks' time, I was fixing a problem that I needed to help me back playing football. And that's how I took it as a 16-year-old. But again, I didn't have that much time to sit and kind of digest, this is for my life. This is like, because 16, you don't think them things. But I remember the night before the operation, I was sitting and I had the operation on a Sunday in October. So I was watching Match of the Day on the Saturday night and I'm laying in the hospital bed. But I was starting to get thoughts in my head that I don't think any 16-year-old should ever go through. I'm sitting there thinking, I could actually die tomorrow. And that in itself, it's hard because, like, what are you, like, I don't know what other way I'm supposed to be thinking. Like, I get I was 16, but that's where I think certain anxieties kind of got suppressed at 16, certain kind of troubles. And that's why football became an even bigger focus for me, because it was the only thing that I actually thought, I'll go in for this, I'm back playing football. That was the only thing taking me mind away from the realities of thinking, when I have this operation, I may not wake up. And that's something that I actually struggled with, but I never spoke and told anybody that.
I mean, like, that's hard enough for anyone to go through at any age, but for a 16-year-old to be going through that, and having those thoughts, because they're quite valid thoughts, really, aren't they? Like, I mean, you could die the next day, I suppose. Open heart surgery, thankfully, I've never had it, but obviously, that's a realistic possibility. And on the other hand, you've got, is this dream that you've had since you were a child going to be completely taken away from you, you know? And I think we spoke about this recently, didn't we? Where I think we were saying, it's the whole thing of it being out of your control, isn't it? So you've got, your life is in the hands of the surgeon. Your heart problem wasn't your fault. That was out of your control as well. It's just like, it isn't it? It's the lack of control. And that's when your mind starts to kind of catastrophize everything. And rightly so as well, isn't it? You know, like, that, fuck me, that's so terrifying for anyone.
Yeah, and I think that was like the beginning of a lot of things. And as I said, I've come to terms with a lot of things nowadays to kind of be able to look back on and say, I'm grateful for it, I'm thankful for it. But at the time, like, I was getting thoughts of, do you know what, maybe I won't wake up and I'm going to just stay awake as long as possible, just to kind of, if I stay awake, it means I'll make it through. Like, there was all these things that were going on, and it was something that even at 16, it just grew me up dramatically. Like, it just made me realize a lot of different things of how much football means to me, how much family means to me, how much everything means to me. And like, it is just something, like, you have all those reasons and it's valid and you try and be positive. But when I had the operation and I came out of it, I remember, like, there was times when I'm sitting in the hospital bed and my mum's sitting next to the bed and I just start bursting into tears, because all that was going through my head was, why did this have to happen to me, mate? Why did this have to be me? Why couldn't just I have a normal life? Why is it that me that I have to fight through this? And even for 16 to have thoughts like that, why always me? And I'm sure there's loads of people out there that will think the same things. But sometimes I think as the years went on, I realized that this was actually something that, you know what, I've made it in the best of a bad situation. I've just given everything a go. I've just kept myself going. And rightly or wrongly, I never really addressed it at the time, I think. But then that gave me the opportunity to overcome it a little bit better because of the distraction of football. But it was something that obviously I had to revisit 3 years ago when I started doing counselling again after the second open heart surgery, because it was something that I never realised it affected me as much as it did. I always just tried to see things as positively as I can. I tried to see things in a way of saying, well, this is the reason why this has happened. And you make a positive out of it and say, well, this was meant to happen to help me career. This was meant to happen. So it makes you deal with it a little bit better. But when I had to sit and revisit it all and realise that there were things going on in my head at the age of 16 and there were things going on in my head during my career that at the time, you just kind of bypass it and say, look, I'll get my head down, I'll get to sleep. But there were some nights where I did have sleepless nights wondering, well, tomorrow could be my last day, because every single season in football, all I had was a heart scan at the end of every single year to tell me if I was able to play the next year or not. And that was my career. And it is very cliche, but it's like, live every day like it's going to be a last. Like, I played every season like it was going to be my last, because that's the reality I had to live with. And sometimes it's not about the situation that you're in and get yourself down about it. It's a way that I looked at it and say, how can I make the best out of this situation and not let it get to me? How can I make the best of it? How do I get along with things? And the suppressed stuff that kind of came along with that was, I always wanted to be treated normally. In football, I wanted to be treated as one of the other footballers, not the kid who's had the open heart surgery, not the one that we need to keep an eye on. Just judge me as a footballer. Judge me as Mark O'Brien. If you're good enough, you're playing. If you're not good enough, well, then I don't want you. That's how I wanted to be looked at. But it was also hard to get away from the fact that people needed to know. So what they needed to know was, am I okay? So I just would say yes, but I never spoke about it. I never bothered talking about it. I just always said, yeah, I'm okay. I had it when I'm 16, but I'm fine now. Whereas even through those times, I still have thoughts in my mind that, do you know what, this is still mentally affecting me more than it was physically.
Yeah. I mean, it's something else we also kind of spoke about recently, wasn't it, where we were saying that the silver lining in this was that if you hadn't gone to England and you hadn't had the scan, you would never have known you had this heart condition, because if you had stayed in Dublin, you probably might never have known you had this heart condition that you were completely unaware of. And you think you were even saying to me, like, that you could have, like, dropped dead playing a match on some Sunday or whatever, and nobody would have known. I don't mean known, nobody would have known why, you know? So,
yeah, and that's exactly it. And that's why I do look back at it with positivity, because I always say that football did save me life. Yeah. And if it wasn't for football and having some sort of talent for football, that, again, we wouldn't be sitting here doing this podcast. I wouldn't be having an 11-year career. I wouldn't have even moved to England. I would have literally been one of those cases that people hear of, that a kid has collapsed on a pitch. And that's how my life would have been. And again, it is scary to think back, but then also I do have to look at it and, like you say, be grateful for it and say that I am one of the lucky ones that can share that message about it, that can be the example that, you know what, maybe a routine scan is needed just to be on the safe side. Maybe if you're going into some sort of sport or some sort of any sort of training, you are better off being safer than sorry, because what you might feel isn't an issue, that could be an underlying one. And that's just kind of how I see things now, that I want to be that example for a lot of people. But even on the other positive side of that, to say that even if you do have issues, or even if you did have an operation, there's still opportunity for you to be some sort of success in your own life. Like, it shouldn't hold you back, because I still have the same struggles nowadays. I still have some of the same sleepless nights, but I choose to work on myself and go seek that help rather than keeping it in now.
Yeah, well, that's there we go. That's exactly it. I mean, I couldn't have put it better myself. You know, like you mentioned actually there, we've go back a little minute, because you mentioned the second open heart surgery. So your first open heart surgery, this is when you're starting to bottle things up really and kind of just say you just want to get on with it really. But when the second, how long, the second open heart surgery, was that, did you say 2 years later you had that one?
No, the second open heart surgery I had 11 years later. So I had right. That second one 3 years ago. So I had that during COVID, which
right.
was difficult, because we were in a bit of a kind of lockdown state with football. Football came to an end because of COVID, which nobody knew what it was. So we all done like our little off-season fitness plan that the club gave us to stay fit just in case football started back, like, because we were in that state of like not really knowing what the whole illness was. So in that time of keeping fit, I remember there was one evening, I just got like I was sitting on my sofa and I just got a really big thump to my chest, and I didn't know what it was, but I remember my neck was pulsing, like I couldn't breathe, and I just felt this strange feeling come over me. So I tried to get some sleep and think, well, I'll sleep it off, this will be fine. And again, the same feeling came to me the next day, and then I wasn't able to lay down on my left hand side. So I'm trying to speak to our club doctor, who again helped me like unbelievably well through all of this. But I text him, he told me it might be something. He said it might be nothing. He said, look, he said, I'll try and get you an echo, I'll try and get you a scan. He said, but obviously during COVID, hospitals were a difficult place to get yourself into. So he ended up finding and getting me a scan. And then I went for this scan and found out that my valve was leaking again, but I got told it was leaking quite badly. And I remember just sitting in the office, and when he came in and told me that, you just go into that like numb feeling of like everything that was pent up, knowing that there was a slight issue, knowing that something didn't quite feel right. I was in that kind of way of thinking, I hope you tell me something's wrong, because I don't know why these feelings are coming, but I hope there's nothing wrong, all at the same time. And when he told me that, I kind of just went numb. Like, I just felt everything came crashing down on me. Like, I knew there and then that my football was finished, because, again, I made that choice at 16 to say one operation was going to be for my career and one operation was going to be for the rest of my life. But this time around, you think you're going to be prepared for it, and you think having a yearly scan, and one of them is never always going to be perfect. You think having all them scans, something's going to give us some stage. But in your mind, I was just running along and I was going with the roller coaster of saying everything's fine. So there was never really that much time to think. But this time when he told me that, I just burst into tears. I literally like sat in his office and I just started crying. And he told me, oh no, there's procedures that we can do to maybe like prolong your career and you can get a prosthetic valve in. And I said, no, I said, like, look, I said, I know the route I'm going down. I know the way my heart is, and I know how everything is, and the metallic valve is what it is. I said, I don't want to have to go through this 3, 4, 5 times in my life. And I said, there's no guarantee on operations, and that's something I said I can accept, but I want to give myself the best chance of something that I want to actually have a life. But this time around, I struggled so much more because of the retirement. There wasn't that distraction, or there wasn't that focus to say I'm getting back for football, because I wasn't. There wasn't that focus of saying I'm doing this for a purpose, because I wasn't. I was doing it for this. And I know it sounds silly to say, like, life is purpose, but I didn't see it like that. I thought my life has come to an end because I don't have football anymore, because football was such a massive driving force for me through before surgery, through certain injuries, through so many different things, that this time, right, I don't have that. So now what am I going to do?
Yeah.
So this is the first time I felt any sort of adversity that I've had in my life actually defeat me, actually get into my head and make me think, like, I don't know what I'm going to do anymore. And I remember with my ex-partner at the time, like, I went back out into her car and I just burst into tears again, told her the news. She cried along with me. And then I phoned my ma. My ma flew straight over the next day. And again, it was that process of going through, right, you need another scan. We need to be able to know when the operation is happening. We need to go and take your bloods. We need to examine you. We need this and need that. And it just kind of brought all the stuff from at the age of 16 all back again. And you're thinking, right, I know what I need to do. But also, like, they say every operation is different, even if it's the same operation. I just seen it as, well, I've had it before. I know what to expect. I'll go and be able to do it again. I'll smash through this. But the fact of the no football, the fact of during COVID where life wasn't normal in any way, the fact of all of them different things, there was such a dark cloud hanging over me. I started to get panic attacks. Never knew what a panic attack was. I started to have health anxiety because all I could do was worry. Never knew what health anxiety was. I started and got myself into depression. And this was like minor before the operation, because after the operation, it only got worse. So I went in for the operation, which this time around, it was 7.5 hours. And I spent 4 weeks in hospital. And the 4 weeks that I spent in hospital, there were ups and downs in there. They thought that the valve was infected, and like, they were giving me exams and tests and everything that was going on. And again, you have every doctor telling me every last symptom, telling me every right and wrong that can happen, telling me everything that can go good and can go terrible, because my family weren't there to listen to it. There was no family allowed in the hospital. So I was sitting in the hospital for 4 or 5 weeks by myself, on a FaceTime away from my family, on the end of a phone to my family. So even on those small walks that you need to do after the open heart surgery, I had my family there before, so they'd make you get out of bed and they'd be there and you'd lean on them a little bit. This time around, I had to do it myself. And I found, and I got that kind of steeliness in myself to say, look, I'm going to keep going. But at a moment like that, you need family. You need people around you. You need that. And the fact I couldn't have that is what really, really mentally got me. Because when you have doctors telling you every single day the ups and downs, and Mark, we think this is, might be wrong, and we think this and we think that, and you're having to absorb and take all that in. Like, sometimes, like, I sat there and I said it to one of the nurses. I said, I can't keep listening to negative anymore. I said, because it's really getting me down. And in all fairness, the nurse really helped me. Like, she stopped the doctors coming in to see me. She just came in and let the surgeon talk to me and tell me everything was going to be okay. Because I said, out of everything that was happening in the hospital, I know they have to give you a worst case scenario, but not once did a doctor say to me, but Mark, you're going to be okay. And that's all I wanted to hear from someone, that you're going to be okay. And the fact that I wasn't getting that, I just always worried and worried. And knowing that I was a click of a button away from a nurse was great. But once I come out of hospital, those four walls didn't protect me anymore. And I just got worse.
Yeah.
And laying in bed, like, I went into a depression, which I never knew what depression was, because what I blamed on the open heart surgery, saying I'm not getting out of bed, I feel so drained and tired, I can't sleep, and I feel moody and I'm snapping at people. But also on the other side, like, I'm crying, and there's all these different feelings that are going on. And I had a doctor, our club doctor, tell me, Mark, you need to do counseling. And I was thinking, well, I don't need to do counseling, I'm fine. Like, because you really underestimate what counseling is. It's literally a chat with somebody that you can offload whatever you need. They give you different perspectives or different ways of thinking. And that is literally it. There was no kind of, like, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with you. It was literally, Mark, tell me your operation. Tell me, what do you think about this? And make you just see it differently to how my mind is processing it. And my mind was processing the operation as, like, I thought I understood it. And I spoke about it so freely. And what the counselling made me realise is that I'm not actually giving credit to the operation, and I'm not giving an understanding to the operation, because I'm talking about it like it's an everyday occurrence. Like, I've just gone in to have my tooth out. Like, I was I remember I was speaking about saying like the reason why I wasn't able to talk properly after the operation was because the ventilator in my throat clipped the vocal cord. But in my mind, that's normal because I had a ventilator in, where the counselor was telling me, but Mark, you had a ventilator in, like you can't be so hard on yourself, you can't be this and that. And it made me realize the severity of everything. And then it makes you kind of a that almost little small little bit of proudness for yourself, and you start gaining that little bit of strength back to kind of go, actually, do you know what? I have been through a lot, and these things have happened, and do you know what? I've not given up. And it just started to slowly like come around that little bit more. But in between all that, I was having sleepless nights. Like I'd have a panic attack on my sofa and I'd stay in bed all the time. And then I'd go to train and come back straight to bed because I was like, if I sit on that sofa, it's going to happen again. And I would stop myself coming into my living room. And then the other thing would happen, would I'd have a panic attack in bed and I'd come and sleep on the sofa because I was thinking, I can't go back to that bed. So I knew everything was so mental. Like, and I knew it was all mental and not physical, but I was convincing myself it was physical because I never understood how your body or how your head can make your body feel a certain way. So there was all these things that were going on that I was just newly figuring out, and to kind of figure it out, as you would say, on the job and figure it out when it's happening, that's the only way I was able to, because I don't think anybody can fully prepare you and say, this is what depression is, this is what mental health is, this is what anxiety is. You kind of have to experience it to understand it that little bit more. And the fact that I did do that has put me in such a more openness of a headspace than I've ever been in before, and more of an understanding of people than I've ever had before. And that's even with people I've grown up with, to family, to everybody. That before having all this, it is like that kind of new little awakening to yourself to kind of say, do you know what? I'm going to use this to try and help somebody now, because I can understand how difficult, because when you don't go through it and you see somebody say, I can't be bothered getting out of bed, your first answer is, well, just get up and see what happens. It's not that simple, because I had them things said to me and I would say no. And like you'd have them back and forwards with people. So having that understanding of going, I understand and I can see where you're coming from, rather than the point of just kind of go, I'm going to fix it. This is what you need to do to fix it. Like, I don't think there's any overnight fix. I think it's just a matter of finding out what's best and comfortable for yourself and you proceeding with that, rather than one shoe fits all kind of situation.
Yeah. Obviously, people listen can't see me, or well, unless they're, if I put up the video, but like if you are watching this, you can probably see me. The more Mark is talking there, the more I'm smiling, because it's so similar to me. I can resonate with so much of what you're saying, because I've done exactly the same, which is why I try and help so many people now. Because when you go through it, you've got more empathy and understanding to what other people are going through. And like my first blog I wrote when I started The End of Spiral, it wasn't even a podcast, it was a blog. It was just for me. And my first blog was called How I Use Sport as an Escapism. But what it really was, and I said this only recently to someone else, is when I go back and read it now, it's actually what I would call it now is How I Use Sport as an Avoidance. Because you kind of sound similar to what I was doing. It's like you're nearly living in denial for so long, and you're using sport as something that you can kind of cling on to. That's your purpose, is your football, yeah, is your purpose. Well, it really isn't, but that's how you know. And I did exactly what you did for so long, is I bottled everything up. I mean, in 11 years of your career, did any club, because I know we spoke recently and I know I keep saying that, but we did, and you had an awful time at one of your clubs, which really fucked up your mental health, wasn't it? And like, did anyone in any time of your career, any club, offer you therapy or counseling? Because I know, didn't we say that they were very good at rehabilitating your body, but you didn't get to, they didn't rehabilitate your mind, which is probably where it was just as important for you.
Yeah, and I think that's when football, you kind of have to seek it for yourself in a nutshell, because I think it's coming a lot more in the game now. I think there's a lot more push towards the mental side of football, just as much as the physical. As much as the physical is a main priority, I think they're starting to realise now that there's a lot more on the mental side that can actually rehab a player and get a player in a better position, because, like you say, it's people's livelihoods. But when I was at Luton Town and you get left out of a team and you get your squad number taken off and you get told to train by yourself and you get basically given the cold shoulder from a club, it is something that really, really affects you. And there was nothing wrong with my body. So then that's how I could never get my head around it even more. And it really did mess with my mental health, because I started to do silly things. I remember I would end up like going out on a Sunday just because I was like, well, I'm not going to be training on the Monday. So what's like, it's not going to affect me. And you just start making silly decisions. But it was even after that one time of doing that, I kind of looked at myself a little bit and I thought, I can't keep doing this. And then that was the club at the time where I thought, I'm better off going home to Dublin, because no matter what I do, no matter how hard I train, because there was always something to walk back to. When I had an injury, it was always something to walk back for, to walk back to playing. There was always something. When I had the open heart surgery, it was to walk back to get playing. But this time I had nothing to work on. I just wasn't allowed to play. So I was trying to figure out time and time and time again, what am I supposed to be doing to play? Like, and there wasn't anyone there to sit and talk. There was a couple of players. There was one staff member in Andy Offord who offered help, like as a one-on-one basis, as in to kind of help me towards football. But I never had anybody mentally try and say, well, Mark, look, I understand what you're going through. Look, you probably are going through a tough time. Like, I didn't have any of that. And that was, to an extent, a fault of my own as much as the club, because a fault of my own was I kept it to myself because I didn't want my family to worry about me, because they always had enough worries about me when I've had the open heart surgeries, when I had this. And when you're living away from home, you want to keep your family as eased as possible. So I didn't want to have to tell people. So you just think, I'm strong enough to take this by myself. I've had open heart surgery. I've had cruciate ligaments. I've had these things. I'll be able to deal with this. But this one was a different kind of mental test, because I was doing everything to deal with it. And I wasn't getting anywhere, and I was having people, and I was having a manager just dislike me for the sake of saying it's business and it's business only. And that was something where it was another uncontrollable, because what I had control of myself was, I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to give in. I'm going to keep going and keep going. But what I couldn't control was the manager's view on me, was the manager's thought process behind what he was doing. But That was the first time that I ever had that little small inkling to myself of saying, enough's enough. Like, I've been through enough of my life now in such a short space of, say, 8 years. I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm done. And that's why at the beginning when I said it, that there was always that little small voice in my head to say, just don't stop. You just never know. Just don't. Because 16, I had the same thing. 16, it was, am I going to play? Am I not? Right, I'm going to give it one go. And this time was, I didn't work so hard to get through all of these different things that I've had in my career to make some sort of life for myself, for one person's opinion to stop me, for one person's for one person's view of me to stop me. And like you say, that's people on their day-to-day life. One person's opinion doesn't matter. And like, I don't know if I'm able to swear, but my dad always turned around and said to me is something where he said, Mark, look, an opinion is like an arsehole. Everybody has one. And it was something, and he said that to me when I was at Luton, because the fans weren't really having me, the manager wasn't liking me, and it was just a terrible time. But that's all my dad said. He said, look, it's one person's opinion. He said, and one person's opinion should not dictate whether you live your dream or whether you don't. Just like some person's opinion shouldn't stop you from doing something in your life that you really want to do. And that's what I took from it. And again, you have to deal with the ups and downs, but I used every past trauma or every past adversity that I had to put into my favor. So like, that was like, obviously my big takeaway from so many things was everything that I went through, I can look back on it and you can hate your time. You can look back on it and think of it as a terrible thing. But I also used that as that little fire that was always just always building time and time again. That the time when I felt I've got nothing left, I'd look back and go, but why did I do that at 16? Because, well, you know what? If I can do that at 16, I can do that now. If I can get back from a cruise, I can do that now. And like, they were all small blessings in any way that have kind of put me in that steely position to say, this is another situation to deal with, and I'm well equipped to deal with it. And thankfully I did.
Yeah, you don't look back and go, I gave up ranting, because you didn't, and you never did, and like that's a great thing to have, isn't it? Like you don't play the victim, and it's not like, you don't blame other people. As you said, you take the positives out of everything, and it's like that's amazing. It's so good to have, because so many people don't have that. It's amazing to have, because like I'm always like trying to advocate for men to open up more and to share more, and because I think one of the reasons why you probably didn't talk to anyone for so long was also the stigma that men have as well, especially in sport, where you don't want to feel like they're you don't want to be judged, or you don't want to be whatever, and you want to have this kind of masculine macho image where, especially as an athlete like you were, you don't want to have people, as you said it yourself earlier on, you didn't want to have people taking pity on you. But like I think the fact that you're even able, but still you're able to look back and not blame other people, I think is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the point. It's like I didn't want my career to be dictated off other people because I worked so hard on everything that I had. Again, you don't want the pity. You don't want people to kind of pat you on the back and kind of give you the easy way through. You don't want people to view you any differently. But at the same time, I think when you're in football, you're always drilled into you that you're seen as a role model. You're in the limelight. Like you have young kids that look up to you. So when you have all of that on your shoulders, as well as not being treated properly, any normal person would probably lash out at a manager and would have a back and forward. But then you also have to believe that you are there to set examples, and that example that you try and set, like it's something that I always believed in, like that's the example that I'm even trying to set in my day-to-day life now. That the example is the more you open up, the better things feel, or the more you open up, the more you realize that there's other people in the exact same position as yourself. So even when I was in football, rightly or wrongly, I didn't really speak about it much. But I think that came from knowing that you are that role model. So then you try and persevere with things and you try and push forward. And but I think because of the way of the world and how we're going into things now, I think it's better for footballers to probably open up, to allow kids to open up more. When the footballer shows his vulnerability, or an athlete shows that vulnerability, and kids might look up to that athlete, they might think, "Well, I felt like that," and then they start talking. So then you can use your role model. Whereas before, it was set a good example of be disciplined, be professional, like do things properly, and all these different things. Whereas now, you have all the same characteristics, but maybe there's a gap for people to say, "Okay, but now talk about how you really feel," and then. It's like the snowball effect. Then you might get kids opening up a little bit more and feeling like, actually, if that Premier League player can talk like that, so can I. I felt like that. And then, like you say, it starts that ripple effect. And like it's something that I've taken on my own shoulders, that I made myself comfortable talking what I was talking about, because I think 3 years ago, if you had asked me, I wouldn't have sat and spoke about anything because I never understood it. But I think I understand it a little bit more now, where I don't sit saying I'm fixed. I don't think it's something that ever goes away. I don't think it's something that
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
going to sit and think I've cracked it and this is the antidote and everybody needs to do this. But I look at it and go, I've found my ways of dealing with it. And some days it does come back and get me. Some days it does come back where I don't want to get out of bed. And there are some days where I do have health anxiety, where I sit and worry about my own health and wonder what all my aches and pains and bumps are. There are other days where I do find myself overthinking a lot. But in the grander scheme of things, I look at it and know that you look back at your past to kind of help you deal with your future and help you deal with your present. And I know there's a lot of saying be in the present and don't worry about your past, just keep looking forward. But sometimes looking back at what you have been through and find yourself being proud of that does unlock that next door to help you go forward. Because if I look back at my past and seen it as so negative, oh, he was injury prone and he's had operations and what could have been, I could have played at a higher level, I could have done this. Well, then you're only setting yourself up for more regret going forward. Whereas I look back and go, this was the circumstance I was dealt with. This is the deck of cards I was dealt with. So how did I make the most of it? And I did. And the fact that I did, I can look at it going, I'm happy where I'm at right now. But going forward, if there's anything that comes your way, I know, well, I can always look back into that to go, well, I made it through this, so now I can make it through this. And it's about just, like you say, finding that next purpose and football was mine, but maybe my next purpose now is to speak so openly about the downs and the ups and everything that I've had, because it's to look back at everything that I've gone through again and say, I've gone through all that for a reason. Make it a positive and say, all that was for a reason to be where I'm at now. And all of that was for an understanding of, when I talk, I actually speak open and honestly, because there are people out there that will feel exactly the same. And you want to be that message to say, well, if I can do it, anybody can do it. Like, and I'm no different to anybody else.
Yeah. I always say exactly the same thing, about, if I hadn't gone through all of that, I wouldn't be the person I am today. I'm always saying that. I completely agree with you. And also, just, you know, what you're saying about looking back at your past, I think as long as you're looking back at your past, as you are, in a kind of a positive way, rather than looking back at it and then, you know, giving yourself a bollocking all the time, that's not healthy. But you're looking back at it in a kind of in a healthy way, which is, it kind of leads me on to the last part of this. So we'll wrap this podcast up very soon. Is the book. So you wrote a book recently, and it's called A Game of Two Hearts, which I think is a great title. Yeah. Did you find writing that book, because I know I do when I write, it's very therapeutic to write and cathartic to write as well, because, you know, when you start writing, all of this just stuff starts flowing out of you that you didn't even know was there. How did you find actually writing the book?
Do you know what? I actually really enjoyed it. It was something that I didn't really know if I would enjoy it. It wasn't something that I actually thought would be for me. I always had people telling me, and my dad used to always say it to me for years, Mark, you need to do a book, because what you've been through in the last 10, 11 years of your life, someone probably won't go through in a lifetime.
Yeah.
So, so when I was getting told all of that, I took the opportunity in doing it, and that opportunity came, and it made me open up that little bit more, but it made me feel finally that this is the next little bit of purpose. That's why I think I'm so passionate about it, because I feel as though it's not just a footballer's book. It's not just a footballer's autobiography where he's moved away, he's had a career, now he's retired, now he's a manager. Like, it's nothing like that. It's literally, football was my job, but my life is just like anybody else's. I've had me scares, I've had me ups and downs, and I've had me times where it's sink or swim. I've had all of them things. And you want people to pick it up and read it and be able to resonate with certain sections, where instead of looking at it as a footballer story, like, you don't have to understand football to read it. You don't have to look at it in a sense that was all that was my job. So you can look at yourself in your own job and still relate back to the feelings that I went through on different ways that you might be dealing with things. And like I say, I just wanted it and want it to be something that will help somebody. And it is something that I found I was scared doing, because you never know how people are going to react to your life. You never know how people are going to respond, whether people are turning around and go, I'm not going to read that, I don't want that. Like, I just had it in my head that it'd be great to have, and my family might want to read it, and it'd be great for me ma to see our son have a book, and all those little things. But the response that I've actually had from it has been the response I was hoping for. The fact that I have had people tell me it's a great read for them, and they resonated with the open heart surgery, they resonated with going through COVID, they resonated with the panic attacks and the anxieties and what health anxiety is. So, like, as much as it is something where I wanted to be a success, I just wanted to help people. And then when I've had people reach out through socials because of the book or because of certain things I've spoken on, that I wanted to, again, help people. Like, so anything that I've done, there's always a purpose to it, and there's always a reasoning behind it, because I just believe that there are going to start unlocking doors for people to kind of go, well, look at the success, or there's some sort of success that he's had in his life. Like, he's no different to me, so why can't I be a success? Or if I know of somebody who's had and who's gone through certain aspects of things in his life, and he's able to sit there and smile and get on and speak out about it, well, then anybody can do it. And as you say, it doesn't always have to be that you have to speak so openly about it, but it's the fact of just opening up that channel to talk to somebody about it. Yeah. And that's always what I always believe in.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, like the fact that there's another man out there just opening up and talking about talking about your, you know, your struggles, and, you know, your good, you know, your good times, but there's bad times as well. And I think the way it's so many people can resonate with it is, like, you're a human being. We all have problems. We all have struggles. We all have issues. But you're resilient. You've got through all of that. You look back at it in a healthy way, and you're now trying to help people and inspire people. And I think the fact that just that alone is incredible, you know. I mean, I'm always advocating for men to share a bit more, you know. And I say that as well. I think you said that something similar a while ago. You're not talking about going out and writing a book or doing a podcast or whatever. It's even just finding someone, as you said, if there's someone sitting in the room beside you, it's easier to share rather than just switching everything off and switching yourself away and bottling things up and never sharing. You know, just even just talking to someone that you trust is important, isn't it?
Yeah, and sometimes, like you say, it doesn't have to be a family member. It doesn't have to be a work colleague. It can be somebody that you source out yourself, that you want to not know anything about your life other than just who they're speaking to there and then. And sometimes people find more comfort in talking to a stranger, talking to a professional that you know it's not going to go any further. My family don't need to know. So at the beginning, as I said, I was like apprehensive about the counselling, but when I actually realised and understood what it's all about, it made me actually like enjoy it that little bit more, to kind of look forward to going, like, oh, I've got so much to tell this person. Like, and then again, like, you, like, it is something where when you do look back on your life and you do look back in that positive aspect, sometimes, like you say, people do look back in a way of going, I went through this and I went through that, what a terrible life I've had. And it's a normal thing to do, just as much as looking back at it in a positive way. But my kind of way of thinking is always, your way of getting out of something is you do what makes you happy. You do what makes you feel good. You do what's right for yourself. You don't do it because I've told you. You don't do it because you've read it somewhere. You don't do it because of this. You do something that is individualized for yourself. And I always believe that if you do something that is able to make you feel good for yourself, and that is something that it gives you that one step in front of the other mentality, that just, let's just keep crawling with it. And let's keep crawling until one day you wake up and go, I actually feel okay today. And then all of a sudden one day becomes 2 days. And it is literally about acceptance. You just have to accept the situation you're in, because some people look back at themselves and say, but that's the person I used to be. I want to go back to be that person. I don't think you're able to ever go back to a person that you were, but you can always come back and be a person that you want to be. And you can always come back and be a stronger person. And because I was in that kind of process of looking back and going, I want to be Mark the footballer. Like, I felt powerful. I didn't feel like this stress. I didn't feel these panic attacks. I just want to be Mark the footballer. And this is what I was on a football pitch. I was a captain. I was a leader. I was this. And I always looked at that and saying, I want that feeling again. And that took somebody to tell me and say, Mark, you'll never be that again. And as hard as it was to hear, but they turned around and said, but Mark, just because you don't play football doesn't mean that's not the person you can't be, because you can still be that person. Football was only a job. Football didn't make you successful. You made your job successful no matter where you went. And understanding that made me realize, well, do you know what? The traits that I have, I'm just going to put into something else. And that something else now is a driving force to say, right, well then, if that next thing of being the talker, the leader, is something to help someone, well, I can do that in my day-to-day life now. And it's not that I look back at it and don't mark the football, or I look at it now and say, oh, I'm a better person than I probably ever have been. And that is better than when I look back at Mark the football, or I'm a better person than that person even now, more mentally, like more physically, more anything, that I look at and say, yeah, looking back, that was a good part of me, but now this is an even bigger and better part. And going forward, that's the only way that I do look at things.
Yeah, as long as you're growing as a person and growing and going in the right direction, that's all you can really ask for, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. I'm not going to add any more to that, because we've covered so much, and you're such a good talker, and you're like, you're so inspirational about what you say, and so much of what you say is similar to what I say as well. So there's no point in me even repeating any of that, because you've actually covered it so well. Mark's book is available on Amazon, and I'm going to put the link to the book in the description of this podcast. Mark, do you want to say anything before we go? Do you want to give your social to be able to put? Because you'd obviously do a lot of inspirational speaking as well, don't you?
Yeah, so I've done a bit of keynote speaking through like adversities and kind of the adversities I've gone through, to kind of what I've done to kind of counteract them things that people can put into their day to day lives, and it's nothing that is like not nobody can do. It's something that everybody can do and see positives and everything. And then as well as that, like me social media, from me Instagram to me Twitters and different things that people can follow, and people can reach out to me, because I'm only ever always one message away, and that's something that I'm more than happy of opening up and texting somebody back if they're struggling, and speaking to people if they need something, just to ask or if they want to know anything. And as you say, if there's something that might take their fancy and wanting to talk to me or anything really, like I'm just there for people to help others, and hopefully people can pick up the book and something can resonate with them just as much.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. They definitely will. And when I share this podcast, obviously I'll be tagging you in. So if you can't find Mark, I'm sure you will. You can go onto my page and you'll see Mark's Instagram and Twitter there as well. Right, I think we're going to finish this up. Mark, thanks very much for giving up your time to do this. And like I said earlier on, it's amazing and it's great just to have another man on the podcast and they will actually talk so openly and so kind of eloquently as well about things. So thanks very much, Mark, for coming on and giving up your time. I really do appreciate that. Right, we'll go. Guys, I'll be back very soon with another episode of the Endless Barrel podcast. I'll see you all very soon. Bye-bye.